For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up on today's show, we'll be talking to C.K. MacDonald about his series of books, The Stranger Times, including the brand new book 3 in the series called Love Will Tear Us Apart. We also chat about the Dublin Trilogy, written under the name Cuieve MacDonald, and we'll find the links between Talking Books and Star Wars. All that and more on today's Read On. C.K. MacDonald is the author of the Stranger Times series of books. Book 1, The Stranger Times, and Book 2, This Charming Man, are both available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. Book 1's also available in Braille. And just out is Book 3 in the series Love Will Tear Us Apart, which we'll talk about in a moment. Also, under the name Cuieve MacDonald, he's the author of the increasingly inaccurately titled Dublin Trilogy, which has 8 books at the moment, with more on the way. All of these books are available in audio, so let's listen to a clip of the newest one. Love Will Tear Us Apart, Stranger Times Book 3, is narrated by Brendan MacDonald.
Tristan Bleeker's mind went blank. Staring down the wrong end of a gun will have that effect on a man. His mouth was dry. His palms were sweaty. He found himself utterly incapable of summoning a single coherent thought. Not that he had much experience of these things, but it was not a normal gun. Instead of the typical straight barrel, the muzzle of this one flared out like the bell of a trombone. He kept his eyes fixed down the centre line of it, as if he might discern the spark in the darkness that would herald the eventful end to his previously uneventful life. It was like looking into the nostril of an irritable dragon, one that could barbecue you with a single breath.
"Do I need to repeat the question?"
asked the voice at the other end of the weapon. It sounded oddly weary, as if Tristram were the 10th or so person it had held at gunpoint that day, and the process was becoming entirely tedious. Tristram's lips moved, but no words emerged. The voice tutted.
"This is not going well."
That's Brendan MacDonald reading from the new Stranger Times book, Love Will Tear Us Apart, which is out now. And the author C.K. MacDonald, our Cuieve MacDonald, joins me now. Now, I believe I got your name right by saying Cuieve.
Bang on. Very impressively. Genuinely, I've done quite a lot of interviews and you, sir, are one of the very few people who managed to get it without asking. To the point where when I meet people now, I generally sort of reintroduce myself when I met them before, because I know people get so scared by the name. Because for anyone listening, it's spelled C-A-I-M-H. And it genuinely helps to have not seen it written down before you try and say it, because the phonetic spelling of it features none of the letters that are in my name. It's ridiculous.
I had a wee head start because I knew a girl called Niamh, N-A-I-M-H, but you're the first Cuieve I've come across.
Yeah, no, weirdly, to be honest, it's not, frankly, a proper name, depending on who you ask, because basically what Cuieve is it's a nicknameified shortened version of Cuivín, which is the original Gaelic of Kevin. So when I was playing in bands and stuff in Dublin, people just started calling me Cuieve, and it sort of hung on and I always liked it. And then as people always go, "Well, is it a stage name?" And you go, no, it's what my wife calls me. It's my name in Irish. It is my name, but it's a version of my name I prefer using. But then obviously the Stranger Times books are a C.K. MacDonald because publishers were terrified of the name. So they were like, can we use a different one for, because, you know, bless them, they're lovely people in Transworld. But you said the meeting genuinely with the editor when it was coming up, because we basically, myself and my agent, already agreed, but it made sense to have my two different sets of books under two different names. But my agent, who's a lovely man, but is tremendously English, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, but tremendously English, and you can literally see him twisting in his chair, dredging, having to ask the question to an Irishman, would you mind changing your name?
Now, as we say, well, we're here to talk about the Stranger Times, but you have another set of books called the Dublin Trilogy, which they were self-published, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, genuinely, this is absolutely true. It was like 2015, 2016, because I wrote a book that's it sort of mixes comedy and crime set in Dublin, The Man at One of Those Faces. And when we went looking for a representation, which is kind of what you have to do before you publish and stuff, nobody was interested. We were told comedy and crime didn't mix. We were actually told genuine feedback we got was that it was too funny and too Irish, which is wonderfully. I'm so tempted to send that guy an email every few weeks. I never do because it's an excessive move. But the temptation to go, by the way, they've now sold for knocking on near, well, not quite a million, but they're heading that direction. So yeah, no, they came out and then people just sort of latched onto them and they sort of built. We were sort of really pleasantly surprised. I'd never written a book before. It turned out I really enjoyed writing them. And then the audiobooks particularly really helped because we got a guy called Morgan C. Jones, who's an incredible narrator. We are blessed with the narrators we have. They're actually, by coincidence, both happen to be Irish. Well, Morgan deliberately was Irish, but Brendan ended up sort of accidentally the guy who does Stranger Times. It's what's really funny about the two voices are they're also two of the premier voiceover artists in Ireland. So every time I ring my mother and she doesn't pick up the phone, Brendan informs me that her mailbox is full. And then when I try and ring my sister at some point, I think it was Morgan who was informing me that she wasn't there. As well as every time I'm sitting in the cinema or something in Ireland or listening to an advert on TV, the amount of stuff they try and sell me in the space of a couple of hours is incredible. But yeah, so and then the audiobooks, people really latched on to Morgan, particularly with the Dublin books, and that really sort of they're very popular. To be honest, I'm a big fan of audiobooks in general from my stand-up days when I listen to them a lot when you're driving around. If you actually want to get good opinions on audiobooks, stand-up comedians, so many of them are massive fans of audiobooks because we do so much driving that I'd imagine, honestly, probably the Oran and IB and then stand-up comedians are probably the two groups in Britain that are most likely to be big audiobook fans. Just a bizarre thing. But yeah, because so many comics, like all my friends, any comics who've read my books, they've all done it through the audiobooks because, you know, because they do so much driving. And I would say the audiobook is honestly probably the best way to, in some ways, I think, enjoy the books. I think the actors involved have done such a good job that I think they really add to it.
Bridget stopped to look in a shop window, checking she hadn't picked up a tail. She'd seen this on telly numerous times. You look in the reflection to see if anyone is following you. It was proving trickier than she'd imagined. In a movie, the extras would all walk by in straight lines and some over-muscled Eastern European guy would stutter-step, look around in confusion, and give himself away. In reality, actual people were proving to be much messier than that. She'd never noticed before, but on a cold winter's day, pretty much everyone was wearing a long black overcoat. It looked like a hitman convention back there.
It's quite unusual that a self-published book has an audio version. How did that come about?
Well, it's just, people were asking. And to be honest, the reason most self-published books don't have audio versions is it's expensive. And in all honesty, and Morgan won't mind me saying this, Morgan, as I said, is one of the top voiceover guys in Ireland. So he's not cheap because he shouldn't be, frankly. I always say that in an interview, I go, he's going to ask for another rise. But he's brilliant. But basically, the books took off and then it sort of made sense. We actually were looking at me doing them myself. To the point where I got myself a little sound recording booth and I started doing lessons because I was a stand-up comedian, but I've never known how to talk properly. Even now, your listeners will be aware of the fact that I speak far too quickly and quite indistinctly at times. So, but we were still going to try and do it with me. And I started, and then the book started taking off. And then we just sort of looked at it and went, oh, maybe we should try and get someone else. And we did some auditions and Morgan was just so good that it's just one of these things where you'd be amazed only when you hear lots of people do it badly, a 5-minute sample. Like, and these are all actors, all due respect to them, but just not hitting lines properly. It's amazing. When you hear that, I was already a fan of how good narrators can be, but you hear a really good person do it and you went, wow, this is so different. Because and Morgan has, if you listen to the books, the great thing about him is actually his delivery is probably slower than most people's would be. Because he has the confidence in what he's doing. And I think he says himself, he's the confidence in the material. So he lets it breathe and it ends up being a much better experience. Because I think a lot of narrators can try and rush through stuff. Whereas he's just got the experience to do that, and he's a wonderful flow to it. So yeah, it just ended up when the book started taking off, and we frankly struck gold and we got a narrator that just fit it perfectly.
Yeah, I've heard sometimes writers say it's a bit of a surreal experience. It almost sounds like they're listening to something they didn't write.
Yeah, it can be. Weirdly, I remember I was at the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival, which I go to pretty much every year. Myself and the wife love it. But I remember it coming up on one of the panels a few years ago, audiobooks. And everybody in the panel went, oh, yeah, I've not heard my audiobooks. No, I mean, I've just heard a sample and it sounded like the guy was a good voice or the woman was a good voice. But I've not sat down and listened to it. And I'm like, wow, really? It's like, I can't not paying attention to the cover. Like, it's a big deal. A good narrator can make a series. And alternatively, a narrator people don't like can kill a series. So, you know, it's really important. Once you've had someone, you know, like I know Brendan, he's on the Strange Times. I know he does a great job. I know Morgan, who does the Bunny books. I know he does a fantastic job. So at this point, I don't check everything. But yeah, certainly for the first book, we were all over it to make sure that it was done as well as it could be. And we were talking to the narrators and stuff like that. Because it's a massively important thing, especially because I write a very diverse bunch of people. And in the Stranger Times, my wife is second generation Ghanaian. And I've used the thing a couple of times where I've based characters on my mother-in-law, which I probably should stop doing for many reasons, not least because it's a challenge to get people to correctly get a female Ghanaian accent correct. Brendan was so great because we were like giving him loads of tips to make sure that he was, you know, getting the accent as he wanted it and stuff. And being a very good actor, he was able to take it all on board. But yeah, we've been very involved in it because I think it's just a massively important part of your book, you know, how the audiobook is.
Here's a clip of Morgan C. Jones reading from A Man With One of Those Faces.
Bridget was an obsessive fan of true crime. Most of her friends, if they read at all, generally went for tedious romance novels. The Rapunzel case was one of those rarities that combined the two. Usually, if the books she read featured any romance, it was over long before the dead bodies started showing up. Jackie Grinner McNair reappearing was dramatic for several reasons, not least of which was that he supposedly died 30 years ago. After wrestling with her conscience for a shamefully small amount of time, she'd decided to ring Paul to tell him what she'd found out. She had promised to keep it to herself, but, despite him slamming a door in her face, she did feel she owed Paul the truth for dragging him into whatever this was. She didn't know what to make of his belief that someone was trying to kill him. On the one hand, he did seem a tad paranoid and secretive. On the other hand, last night, someone had actually tried to kill him. She figured that she, of all people, had to cut the guy some slack on that front.
Now, you've got the Douglas Adams problem with the Dublin trilogy. You called it a trilogy before you were finished.
Yeah, that was not a clever idea. Bear in mind now, the Dublin trilogy now has 7 books in it, and it's going to have a lot more, because what basically happened was I had an idea for the 3 books, then I realized fairly quickly that the third book was actually a prequel set 15, 20 years beforehand, and then another book, and it made sense to have them split up. So I ended up doing book 1, book 2, prequel, and then what now is book 4, because people got confused about the prequel, so prequel is now book 3. But then, being the idiot I am, there's like a 15, 20 year gap between the prequel and the first book proper. And I've just started writing the books in there. And people like them. And it's all about Bunny in his earlier days. And we now have done, I've done 3 sequels to a prequel. And there will be definitely several more, because they're a lot of fun to write. And as well as that, then it sort of spun off into McGarry Stateside, which is a series that now has 3 books in it, which follows the main character, Bunny McGarry, to America. And I've even done, there's also a spin-off where the other characters that basically were in the Dublin trilogy outside of Bunny set up their own detective agency that happens in the Dublin trilogy. So they're actually running a detective agency. And we now have 2 books with them as well, The Final Game and Decky Must Die. So yes, the chronology thing of how we have to literally do like a quite detailed graph to explain to people. Well, and the other thing is just read them in the order they're in, enjoy the books, and you'll be fine. But yeah, I haven't, if I was working with a publisher instead of doing this myself, I would imagine they'd be having a breakdown because of how I've done it.
So the Star Wars films, what order do you watch them in?
It's very much like that. Yeah, there's a lot of spin-offs and diversions, and I've done a one-off that's a spin-off of the spin-off. Yeah, I've made it confusing. So it's basically just pick any books you've not read and read them, and they don't need to be in that much of an order, I think, for people to get them, hopefully.
When you're sitting down to write, is there a difference between CK writing a book or Queeve writing a book?
The books that, you know, the method I kind of use is generally the same. I sort of lay things out. I've got a pin board beside me here in my office where I've got all the different colored cards, which is all about the what's happening in each chapter. The biggest difference is a very good question. The biggest difference between the books are typically when I do, as you call them, the bunny books, generally they are primarily focused on one character. So it's all in the third person, but you're following mostly Bunny. Now, there will always be stuff with other characters, but he's the main focus. Whereas in The Strange at Times, it's much more of an ensemble because it's the staff of the newspaper. And the newspaper is it's based in Manchester. It's a thing called, like, the 14 Times, I mean, I was that as a good example. It's the 14 Times reports weird and wonderful news from around the world. And my idea as a big fan of the 14 Times was to do like a Strange at Times, like a tabloid version set in Manchester. It reports weird and wonderful news from around the world. But then they start realizing that some of the stuff isn't as crazy as they thought it was. And there really is some strange stuff going on. And basically it ends up being in a kind of magical world, but a very different version than you'd probably read most of the books. So that's the idea from the book. But because of that, because it's an ensemble of journalists, there's a lot more going on. Like, there can be three different storylines to various degrees in a Strange at Times book, whereas generally in the Bunny book, it's primarily much more focused on one thing. So the Strange at Times is, if you like, a more complex thing to write because there's much more moving parts.
Yeah, because Hannah turns up, there's a guy on the roof going to throw himself off, there's a guy with a blunderbuss, there's a Simon's sitting outside wanting a job.
Yeah, there's quite, I mean, the story behind, because that's like the first few chapters of the Strange at Times book, the very first book in the series, obviously, is I wrote it, I think probably about 15 years ago now, as a sitcom script. And my agent at the time just didn't really, I remember writing and putting it in, and my agent just didn't really get it. I think it was something that didn't really connect with her, so it didn't go anywhere. I'm still trying to find the original script, but I basically thought of the idea like 15 years later, and I thought, oh, I always really enjoyed that. And I had the idea while we're walking to my office in Manchester going, oh, it should be here. And it was one of those things where it all just sort of fit together. And by the time I finished walking to my office, I was running upstairs to get to a pad and paper and start scribbling down ideas because it just seemed to fit so perfectly.
So that's a real church.
The church is, yeah, it's based on a church that's now, because the offices of the Strange at Times are based in a former church, if anyone, and the, on my way to my office, as it was at the time, I've since moved, but when I was walking through, there's a church, a former church that's now a community centre, which I took as the idea of the Strange at Times offices, yeah. And then I used to go out every day for like an hour and a half walk. I was doing the 10,000 steps thing that I'm sure people are familiar with. So I was doing a lot of walking around. So I was, and bizarrely, there's quite a lot of churches in Manchester, is one of the things I noticed when walking. So it's kind of based on a few different ones. But yeah, I like the idea of using a former church. But yeah, a lot of things like that are just bits of Manchester that I've picked up. And the great thing about something like this is, obviously, my version of Manchester, because it's all this magical stuff and all, well, the modern, it's like, it exists in a world where, like, everyday people don't realize there's stuff going on, but there's still a lot of stuff going on. And the lovely thing about it is you can take parts of the real Manchester and you build my world on top of it. So there's like, I've done weird things with like pubs and stuff like that that I know I've changed the name, but I've taken them. So in my head, there's kind of a growing map of all these things in Manchester where these various things happen. And Manchester's a great place for it because in the best way possible, Manchester is a wonderfully weird city. It has genuine, I hate using the phrase, but it's true, characters. It has those kind of odd people. You will see the guy who went to the Hacienda in the 90s and never came home. Like, he literally be dancing to the sound of traffic lights changing. You will see these kind of people around, and they just sort of add to the flavour of Manchester, and I like to incorporate them in the book if I can.
Now, you mentioned the Hacienda. The second book's called This Charming Man. The third is Love Will Tear Us Apart. Is music quite an influence on you?
Yeah, I mean, I used to be in bands and stuff, so it's always in my head. And I mean, Manchester, just music's a massive part of the culture here. In a way that, I mean, everywhere has a bit of it, but like Dublin, I grew up in, obviously music's a massive thing there. And probably, I would say possibly in Scotland as well, you might have, you know, particularly around Glasgow or something, that's a big part of it. But there are, yeah, it's a big part of Manchester, so it made sense. I mean, the first book was had to be called The Stranger Times because that's the series. But we had Grounds for Divorce was the title I had in it at one point, which is an Elbow song. And it just made sense that This Charming Man fits the second book perfectly. And actually, so does Love Will Tear Us Apart. They're one of those titles where they just fit. And there's so many great songs associated with Manchester that there's so many titles. I mean, the next book is going to be called Relight My Fire from the Take That song. And the reason for that, by the way, is I was actually, when you do a thing, when you pitch your next three books to your publishers, you have to just write up a thing. And I was looking for a title that fit an idea I had. And I couldn't find one. And I was looking through all these song titles. And I texted my mate Gary, who's a big fan of zombie movies and everything zombie. He literally has a room in his house that's full of zombie stuff. And I just texted him and said, Relight My Fire is a really funny title for a zombie book. And he's like, oh, yeah, it really is. And I literally came up, the whole idea happened really fast, came up with the whole idea of the book based on the title. It took me like 20 minutes. And it's probably, of all the ideas I've had for books, it's my favorite one. And I'm really looking forward to writing it because it's such a fun idea. But that all came out of a song title as well, yeah.
In these circumstances, the cliché was that your life should flash before your eyes. But that wasn't happening for Tristram. Instead, the first 10 minutes of his interview kept replaying in his head, over and over, as if his mind were trying to process how things had reached this alarming state of affairs. He must have done something very wrong at some point. Tristram was good in interviews. Everybody said so. He was personable, articulate, and a master of brevity. He'd been warned to expect the unexpected today, and, to that point, he thought he'd dealt well with the curveballs thrown his way. Then he'd found himself staring down the barrel of this weird gun.
"The question," said the voice, sounding increasingly irritated, "was, how well do you handle pressure?"
The new book, Love Will Tear Us Apart, Stranger Times, been out for about a couple of weeks now. Tell us about the new book.
Well, the new book, sort of a thing that happens, Bancroft is the editor of the Stranger Times, Vincent Bancroft, who is a awful human being in many ways. he's the guy who says the stuff you shouldn't say. He's like horrendous. If you had to actually live with him or work with him, he'd be horrendous. But as someone who gets to write him, he's an absolute delight because he says the things you don't say. And he is caustic and just constantly ripping people down. So he's a joy to write. But he's not just that. And one of the themes that's been in the books is he was the Fleet Street darling. He was one of the most powerful editors of British tabloids, and his fall from grace was his wife died and he kind of went off the rails. He wouldn't accept she was dead, literally couldn't accept the idea his wife was dead, despite the fact there was conclusive proof in a body and all that. And then in the third book he starts getting messages from her, so that's the big part of it. There's also stuff like, we look at the kind of, there's quite a lot involving the idea of celebrity wellness cults and that kind of thing, which is a growing thing that we've all seen. So that's the main thrust of it, is kind of what's going on there with those two different things.
Here's Brendan MacDonald reading from the new book, Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Tristram coughed and was surprised to realise he had recovered the power of speech.
"I think what Mr. Bancroft is trying to say is that I am overqualified for the role."
"No, I'm not trying to say anything. What I am saying is that you are perfectly qualified for the role. Too perfect. Now, run along before I lose my temper. And do let your handlers know that if they try this kind of thing again, next time I will not take it in such good spirits. Speaking of which..."
Bancroft picked up the bottle of Irish whiskey that sat on his desk and poured himself a healthy measure, then kept pouring past the point of unhealthy, all the way to death wish.
"There's clearly been a misunderstanding here," said Tristram, trying to sound jovial. "Nobody has sent me."
"Right."
Bancroft patted the gun.
"Well, you've got until the count of 10 before I shoot you. Then, if nobody claims the body after a week, I shall offer your corpse a full and grovelling apology."
Now, I'm going to ask you a question based on a headline attributed to you. Are British publishers scared of funny?
I'm probably far too honest in these things. I would say, look, yes and no, in the sense that I think they're fine with celebrity funny, if I'm honest. I mean, and I speak as someone who's, you know, I know a lot of the bigger comics in Britain. So if they want to do a book, they're always delighted with that. And look, those books can be very good. Sarah Millican's book's fantastic. A lot of comics have written good books. Jason Manfred's one's very good as well. So they're fine with that. I think they are a little bit wary. Even like Richard Osman's books have done brilliantly. Great books. People love them. And they obviously are. There's an element of comedy in them. And I remember asking my agent, frankly, I said, oh, do you think they're going to be warming up to the idea of comedy crime? And he said, to be honest, no. What they've taken, the lesson publishing has taken from Richard Osman is, we should get people who are already famous to write books. That's the lesson they're taking, not that comedy and... Because I think there is an element there. I mean, look, I'm very lucky. Transworld have been great, and they're my publishers for The Stranger Times. They were Terry Pratchett's publishers, so they were more than happy to believe that you can combine fantasy and comedy and, you know, do well with it. So they've been absolutely fantastic. But, I mean, put it this way, like, when my book's in Germany, we had a... Ironically, for this stereotype people have of Germans, which is a lazy stereotype about the no sense of humor, they actually love comedy books over there, particularly bizarrely British comedy. They're very big. Douglas Adams, Terry Pratchett and stuff. To the point that I've done like a tour in Germany doing events, and it is quite bizarre as an Irishman, but my books get described as British comedy. And it's just because they... And well, as a Scot yourself, you might get a little bit sensitive when people suggest you're one thing and you're not the other thing. But when you realise they're putting you in the same brackets as Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams, it's the highest compliment you could pay me as an author. So I just take it as the compliment it is. And I've stopped, you know, correcting people, shall we say. So, but yeah, weirdly, British publishing is a little bit more reticent about British humor than the Germans are, which is so bizarre. So I think there are, I don't know, hopefully it'll change over time. I think it's one of these things that publishing in general can be a little scared of things. And then somebody breaks out and all of a sudden they rush to try and find that thing. It just comes down to the fact that, I mean, editor, it's not, it's the way publishing works is you have to go into a meeting with marketing people and tell them this book is like these books and these books have sold previously. So because of that, they end up looking for what they know and they're scared of things that step outside the area. But there's loads of good British books that are funny, that are, you know, J.D. Kirk and all these, there's loads of different people who've done really well in the space of writing comedy and crime, that if publishing paid attention, they'd go realize and go, oh, there is actually, people want that stuff. People like enjoy, particularly in the crime area, they enjoy crime, but people are looking for fresh takes on the genre because there's so many books out in that genre now. So hopefully hopefully the situation is improving, but yeah, it does take time.
Yeah, there is a bit of a void since we've lost Pratchett and Douglas Adams as well. There is a space for that in the market.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would hope. I mean, it's weird. My books are, to be honest, we get, again, particularly in Britain, we've got the Terry Pratchett thing a lot, to the point it's been mentioned in a lot of press reviews, which is, Terry Pratchett, to be clear, is my all-time favourite author. It is the highest honour. I'm so, you know, but in all honesty, well, the humour might be maybe in the same area, but my books are set in contemporary Britain, if you like, you know, the modern day. A more accurate probably comparison would be the Rivers of London books by the brilliant Ben Aronovich. That's probably a more contemporary thing to me. But yeah, the thing with those things is Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams, because they're so good and revered, rightly so, that when people compare anything to them, it gets the fan bases of those people up. And I speak as someone I've been in the same situation. Like, even Transworld, who are Terry Pratchett's publisher, will tell you they are very careful about saying the word Terry Pratchett associated with another author because it can really wind people up, which I totally get. So it is, there's a gap there, but weirdly there's a gap there because the people who went before are almost so revered that publishers are scared to try and put something else in that space, if you think so. But, you know, again, these things will change over time.
Now, you mentioned your books available in Germany, and I've talked to Christopher Brookmeyer about this, that he sometimes had phone calls from translators who just cannot get their head around the joke. You know, it's too Scottish for them. Have you had that problem yourself?
Yes, I'm a big fan of Chris Brookmeyer, by the way. But yes, absolutely, to the point where my narrator in Germany is fantastic. And I actually was lucky enough to meet him and we did a couple of events and all together. But, oh, I've had that. And weirdly, the biggest thing we currently have, because my publishers in Germany now have bought the rights to the Bunny books in German as well, which is great. And it's coming out this year. And they're doing A Man at One of Those Faces now. And the big debate we are currently having is trying to figure out, I don't know if you're allowed swearing on this podcast. If not, apologize. You can just take this bit out.
I'll bleep it.
Oh, okay. But basically, the Irish word gob we had to find an accurate sort of word to put beside that in German. And they were really struggling to the point where I've literally been talking to them. And I'm actually, there's a great Irish comedian, Gerald Regan, is a good mate of mine. He does a brilliant thing about what a gob is in his stand-up. And I'm literally going to send them the link in the hope that they'll go, oh, okay, I get it now. Because he does a brilliant thing about that. There's the thing with generally the jokes and stuff, they mostly get. I mean, there'll always be certain references, but so far they've been very good on that. The hardest thing I did, and this is something I'll hold my hands up, it never occurred to me. In This Charming Man, there's a big thing where Bancroft is a very aggressive way we talk, and I wanted a reason in the books that I didn't want him swearing all the time because it would be a bit excessive. So in the books, in The Stranger Times, he's basically made an agreement with Grace, who's the office manager. She refused. She's going to walk out if he swears. So he has to find ways around swearing. And in the second book, he comes up with his creative system where he comes up with a board with swear words on it with numbers beside them. So he doesn't say the word, but he's referring to the swear word on this board of swear words that he has made up. So I did that. It works great in the English version. But then the German, I remember speaking to the German narrator, went, do you have any idea how hard that was to come up with as many different swear words? Because he actually said, we discovered we don't have as many swear words as the British and the Irish do. And not only that, I went, oh my God, this has been translated now into about 8 or 9 different languages so far. Every single one of these will have had someone as a translator go trying to find the check for 12 different swear words that they weirdly never directly refer to. But I just made it a nightmare. And it's like to the point where I have to send an apology to every narrator that we've had.
Right, finally, I'm aware this question might go on for a while, but the final question I'll ask is, right, what's next?
Oh, what's next? Well, more Stranger Times books. We signed up for 3 more of them. There's going to be more because I've literally just scratched the surface. And especially with the Stranger Times books, I've also done, there's the Stranger Times podcast where I do, which is available everywhere, where I do short stories that I write in the Stranger Times world, which has just built the world out for me, which has been fantastic. So, because I can say with the Stranger Times, I've written 3 books in it now, and it doesn't even feel like I've almost started. I have so much I want to do with the Stranger Times. So there'll be that, and there'll be loads more Bunny books will be down the line. You know, as long as I'm alive, I'm going to keep writing those because I enjoy them so much. And people always ask about which I prefer. And honestly, the big secret is they make each other better. I like doing each of them, and it's always great to, if I was just writing books in one area with one character, I think I'd always worry that I might burn out. Because I get to swap between things, it just keeps everything fresh for me. And I'm more excited now about writing books than I have ever been.
Tristram turned and ran for the nearest exit. En route, he tripped over one of the many piles of books on the floor and crashed head first through the door. In his hurry, he'd left through a different door from the one he'd come in. And this was how he came to find himself sprawled on the threadbare carpet of an open-plan office area. 3 people were seated behind desks and drinking mugs of tea. A portly white man in a 3-piece tartan suit, an East Asian man tossing a yo-yo up and down, and a black teenaged girl with purple hair who didn't look up from her phone. Tristram pointed behind him in the direction of Bancroft's office.
That man is a monster!
His words were met with a round of nonchalant nods. Then, the portly gent in the 3-piece suit turned to his colleagues.
I have to say, these new biscuits are a bit dry.
The Stranger Times, This Charming Man, and The Brand New Love Will Tear Us Apart are all available in audio as narrated by Brendan McDonald. The first 2 books are in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and book 1 is also available in Braille. And all of the books sitting underneath the umbrella of the increasingly inaccurately titled Dublin Trilogy are available as narrated by Morgan C. Jones. And Queeve will be back at the end of the show with the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. And in a moment, we'll find some connections between RNIB Talking Books and Star Wars.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Reading or listening to a great book is an important part of life, whether it's for education, to give you a laugh, or to just get lost in an adventure. Well, RNIB's Reading Services online library is here for you. Listen to a book on your phone or tablet, or just tell your Amazon smart speaker to play your latest talking books.
To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Or if you prefer Braille, download a book and read on an electronic Braille display, such as the Orbit Reader. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the RNIB helpline and tell them that you're interested in the reading services or any of the other great RNIB services we offer. The helpline number is 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
The Talking Book Service from RNIB has approximately 350 professional narrators, and currently amongst that number is an X-Wing pilot, a Star Destroyer commander, a junk dealer from the planet Tatooine, and even an Ewok. In the library, you'll also find books written by Jedis and read by droids. And one regular narrator from back in the day once commanded the first Death Star. That X-Wing pilot was Garrick Hagen, who reads Star Wars, Rogue Planet.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. The garbage pit race was illegal, of course. The authorities on Coruscant tried to maintain the image of a staid and respectable metropolitan planet, capital of the Republic, center of law and civilization for tens of thousands of stellar systems. The truth was far otherwise, if one knew where to look, and Anakin instinctively knew where to look.
3 years after the events of The Phantom Menace, young Anakin Skywalker and Jedi Knight Obi-Wan Kenobi encounter a mysterious world. Dispatched to the planet Zonama Seacoat, source of the fastest ships in the galaxy, the pair are swept up in a swirl of deadly intrigue and betrayal.
"You're speaking of the Republic?" Tarkin asked with more than a hint of disdain. His training, he came from an old and well-established military family, gave his voice a particular edge, both world-weary and amused. "Not at all," Sinar said, smiling at his old friend. Beyond and below the parapet, 4 advanced project ships approached completion. Black, sleek, smaller than previous models, and very fast indeed.
From the book Star Wars Rogue Planet, read by Garrick Hagen. And if you want more from that era, Garrick also reads the book based on the screenplay of Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
Qui-Gon placed a hand on the Gungan's shoulder. "Just relax, my friend. The Force will guide us."
"The Force? What is the Force?"
Jar Jar did not look impressed.
"Makes a big thing, this Force, you betcha. Gonna save me, us, all us, huh?"
Obi-Wan closed his eyes in dismay. This was a disaster waiting to happen.
Garrick Hagen reading from the novelization of Star Wars The Phantom Menace. Whatever your feelings about The Phantom Menace, it did feature a great character in Watto, the junk dealer from Tatooine who owned the slaves Shmi and Anakin Skywalker.
"How isn't he going to pay for all of this?"
"I have 20,000 Republic dactaries."
"Republic credits? Republic credits are no good out here. I need something more real.
I don't have anything else, but credits will do fine.
No, they won't.
Credits will do fine.
No, they won't. What, you think you're some kind of Jedi waving your hand around like that?
The voice of this CG character is provided by Talking Books narrator Andy Secombe, who has narrated many children's books, including some Robo-Dogs, some Battle of Ben Kingdom, and The Accidental Prime Minister.
And there are many awful sounds in this world. Fingernails down the blackboard. Mum singing the theme tune to Match of the Day in the shower. Bagpipes being played madly. In fact, bagpipes being played brilliantly as well. But there are none worse than the sound of an alarm clock early on a Monday.
The voice of Andy Secombe there. He's also read some grown-up books by Ben Elton, by Derek Robinson, and some fantasy from Joe Abercrombie with the First Law trilogy.
Logan plunged through the trees, bare feet slipping and sliding on the wet earth, the slush, the wet pine needles, breath rasping in his chest, blood thumping in his head. He stumbled and sprawled onto his side, nearly cut his chest open with his own axe, lay there panting, peering through the shadowy forest. The dogman had been with him until a moment before, he was sure. But there wasn't any sign of him now. As for the others, there was no telling. Some leader, getting split up from his boys like that. He should have been trying to get back. But the Shanker were all around.
Reading from Joe Abercrombie's The First Law trilogy, that was the voice of Watto from Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, Andy Secombe. Now, before J.J. Abrams announced he was working on The Force Awakens, Star Wars fans had a sequel trilogy in book form from Timothy Zahn.
Luke? The voice came softly but insistently. Luke Skywalker turned to look. An equally familiar figure stood there watching him. "Hello, Ben," Luke said, his voice sounding sluggish in his ears. "Been a long time."
In the first, Heir to the Empire, it has been 5 years since the defeat of Darth Vader and the destruction of the Death Star. A new republic has been established. Han Solo and Princess Leia are now married and expecting twins. And Luke Skywalker, the first in a line of new Jedi Knights, hears a voice from the past, warning him to beware of the dark side.
The landscape seemed to tremble, and abruptly a small part of Luke's mind remembered that he was asleep. Asleep in his suite in the Imperial Palace, and dreaming of Ben Kenobi. "No, I'm not a dream," Ben assured him, answering Luke's unspoken thought. "But the distances separating us have become too great for me to appear to you in any other way. Now, even this last path is being closed to me."
Hayward Morse, reading from Star Wars Heir to the Empire by Timothy Zahn. He also voiced the other two books in the trilogy, Dark Force Rising and The Last Command.
The comm clicked off. "We're going in?" Rogue 11 asked. "We're going in," Wedge confirmed, bringing his X-Wing around in a tight starboard turn. "Rogue 2, give Command a quick update and tell them we need some support. Don't mention Aves by name. Just tell them we're coordinating with an independent resistance group inside the shipyards." "Got it, Rogue Leader." "What if Akbar doesn't want to risk it?" Rogue 7 put in. Wedge looked out at the lights of the shipyard. So, once again, as it had so many times before, it was all going to come down to a matter of trust. Trust in a farm kid, fresh off a backward desert world, to lead him in an attack on the first Death Star. Trust in a former high-stakes gambler, who might or might not have had any real combat experience, to lead him in an attack on the second Death Star. And now, trust in a smuggler, who might just as easily betray him for the right price. "It doesn't matter," he said. "With or without support, we're going in."
The voice of Hayward Morse, reading Star Wars The Last Command by Timothy Zahn. One of the many books in the Talking Books library with a connection to the Star Wars saga. The Talking Book service is now free and easier than ever to join. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
Chewie,
we're home.
And now a return to Queeve, or C.K. MacDonnell, for the books of his life. So, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I think the one I'm going to pick is, and this would be no surprise to anyone who knows my work, but Garrett's Garrett by Terry Pratchett, which I've checked. I was 14 when it came out. That's still my childhood. I'm going to hang on to that. But yeah, I love that book. I mean, I'm a big fan of his books generally, but it's the first of the City Watch series, which are my all-time favorite books. And it features Sam Vimes, who's my all-time favorite character. So I think that's a book that had a massive effect. His books in general had a massive effect on me as a kid, I think. It generally formed my worldview as well as my love of that kind of writing. But yeah, Garrett's Garrett was massive for me.
It wasn't only the fresh mountain air that had given Carrot his huge physique. Being brought up in a gold mine run by dwarfs and working a 12-hour day hauling wagons to the surface must have helped. He walked with a stoop. What will do that is being brought up in a gold mine run by dwarfs who thought that 5 feet was a good height for a ceiling. He'd always known he was different, more bruised for one thing, and then one day his father had come up to him, or rather come up to his waist, and told him that he was not, in fact, as he had always believed, a dwarf. It's a terrible thing to be nearly 16 and the wrong species.
"We didn't like to say so before, son," said his father. "We thought you'd grow out of it, you see."
"Grow out of what?" said Carrot.
"Growing. But now your mother thinks, that is, we both think, it's time you went out among your own kind. I mean, it's not fair keeping you cooped up here without company of your own height." His father twiddled a loose rivet on his helmet, a sure sign that he was worried. He added,
"But you're my kind," said Carrot desperately.
"In a manner of speaking, yes," said his father. "In another manner of speaking, which is a rather more precise and accurate manner of speaking, no. It's all this genetics business, you see, so it might be a very good idea if you were to go out and see something of the world."
"What, for good?"
Oh, no, no, of course not. Come back and visit whenever you like, but, well, a lad your age stuck down here, it's not right. You know, I mean, not a child anymore, having to shuffle around on your knees most of the time and everything. It's not right."
"What is my own kind, then?" said Carrot, bewildered. The old dwarf took a deep breath.
"You're human," he said.
"What, like Mr. Varnashi?" Mr. Varnashi drove an ox-cart up the mountain trails once a week to trade things for gold. "One of the big people?"
"You're 6'6", lad. He's only 5 foot."
The dwarf twiddled the loose rivet again.
"You see how it is."
"Yes, but maybe I'm just tall for my height," said Carrot desperately. "After all, if you can have short humans, can't you have tall dwarfs?"
His father patted him companionably on the back of the knees. "You've got to face facts, boy. You'd be much more at home up on the surface. It's in your blood. The roof isn't so low either."
"You can't keep knocking yourself out on the sky," he told himself.
Nigel Player reading from Guards, Guards, the eighth novel in the Discworld series by Terry Pratchett. Available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
Well, we've mentioned him earlier on. He's one of my all-time favourites, Christopher Buckmire. I could pick several again, but I think Country of the Blind is the one I must have read it now about 10 times, I'd say, if I'm honest, in an audiobook in all different formats. It's just fantastic. It's a wonderfully taught thriller. Incredibly funny when it's trying to be funny, and its view on the world, if anything, has only got more relevant because Chris Bruckmeyer is just a brilliant, perceptive way in the way he writes about the world around him. So he's just always a delight, and there's just great comfort in those characters, so I come back to it again and again.
Caliban wasn't just being facetious or gratuitously offensive, even though he had an effortless talent for both. Unlike the many thousands of people who would be having a little chuckle over their cornflakes this morning, or maybe an extra drink before bed last night after catching the late news, his score with Voss was personal. Mutually. And Sarah knew that. Which was why, despite her efforts to hide it, he could tell she had been a little on edge before going out to work. She obviously hadn't wanted to overstate her case, but he could read the point she needed him to consider. People do just get killed, murdered even. It can happen to anybody, even evil, scheming, right-wing billionaires. Just because his demise would cause wider ripples than normal didn't mean there was more to Voss's death than met the eye. Hey, hey, my, my. Parlebane was a connoisseur of conspiracy theories. It had been remarked upon that he was so paranoid he should have been a Catholic, better yet, a Celtic supporter. He considered his own thoughts on Voss that morning. He couldn't just die, not someone like that. Even if there was a revenge motive, even a terrorist motive, how could four guys, two of whom had to be well into their 50s, circumvent the kind of security there must have been and take out two trained bodyguards? But then he could hear Sarah's voice talking again about the mythology that seems to grow like a fungus upon the corpse of a dead celebrity. Some people can't deal with the loss, with the thought of a world darkened by the snuffing out of that bright star. Voss hadn't exactly brought light to Parlebane's world, but he still had a very special place in his thoughts, in that most volatile of compartments, the one marked unfinished business. And that, Sarah would surely tell him, was the problem. He needed Voss to still be there, and with no more life, he had to find greater meaning in his death, like Elvis Presley, like John Lennon, like Marilyn Monroe, like JFK. Nah. Sarah was probably nervous because of the timing. Less than a month to the wedding, promises made and, so far, promises kept. Then this. The last temptation of Parlebane. Look upon it as a challenge, she had said, as much in consolation as encouragement. You can still be the world's most paranoid and irritating investigative reporter. You just have to do it without playing fast and loose with the police, the security forces, or the laws of physics. It was what he had to agree to before she would agree to becoming his wife. No more recourse to his less conventional journalistic techniques, viz. Picking locks, scaling buildings, burgling offices and hacking computer systems. There's no point in me marrying someone who's soon going to end up in prison or even dead. Why not? Your last husband was dead when you married him. No, Jack, Jeremy was undead. There's a subtle difference.
That's Kenny Blythe reading from Country of the Blind by Christopher Brookmeyer. Available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently is fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
What I'd recommend, there's a few, but I think I'm going to go with Half Bad by Sally Green, which was interesting because it's actually a Netflix series. I think it's called The Bastard Son and the Devil Himself. I think they've even renamed the book, but it was originally called Half Bad. And it's a trilogy of books. And it's a sort of, it gets described a lot as an adult Harry Potter, which I don't like as a thing. Just, I've no problem with Harry Potter at all. It's a great series of books, but I always feel it's weird. They always try and relate everything to Harry Potter. But they're great. It's sort of a paranormal thing. And it's, they're quite full on, but they're, you know, quite dark. They are quite adult in content, but they, the way they're written and everything, just the way the story's told, where it's quite short, choppy chapters. Really interesting way of writing. Great story and told really well. I'd highly recommend it.
Sometimes she tries to mess with your head. Of course, by changing the routine. Sometimes she wants chores before exercises. But most days, it's press-ups first. You'll know which while still zipping up. 50. She says it quietly. She knows you're listening. You take your time as usual. That's always part of the plan. Make her wait. Rub your right arm. The metal wristband cuts into it when the shackle is on. You heel it and get a faint buzz. You roll your head, your shoulders, your head again, and then stand there, just stand there for another second or two, pushing her to her limit, before you drop to the ground. 1, not minding. 2 is the trick. 3, the only. 4, trick. 5, but there are 6. Lords of 7, tactics 8. Lords 9, on the lookout. 10, all the time. 11, all the time. 12, and it's 13, easy. 14, because there ain't 15, nothing else. 16 to do. 17, look out for what? 18, something. 19, anything. 20, N. 21, E. 22, thing. 23, a mistake. 24, a chance. 25, an oversight. 26, the. 27, tiniest. 28, error. 29, by the. 30, fairborn. 31, which. 32, from. 33, hell. 34, cause she makes. 35, mistakes. 36, oh yes. 37, and if that mistake. 38, comes to. 39, nothing. 40, you wait. 41 for the next one. 42 and the next one. 43 and the next one. 44 until 45, you. 46, succeed. 47 until 48, you're. 49, free. You get up. She will have been counting, but never letting up is another tactic. She doesn't say anything but steps towards you and backhands you across the face. 50. 50. After press-ups, it's just standing and waiting. Best look at the ground. You're by the cage on the path. The path's muddy, but you won't be sweeping it. Not today. Not with this plan. It's rained a lot in the last few days. Autumn's coming on fast. Still, today it's not raining. Already it's going well.
That's Carol Prekop reading from Half-Bad, the Half-Bad Trilogy, Book 1 by Sally Green. Available commercially. And Cuaoimh MacDonald, thank you so much. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back with more book news, reviews and author interviews at the same time next week. Or if you can't wait that long, there are over 300 episodes in the podcast feed. Just search for R&IB Read On in your favourite podcast app. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at @talking_books. And Cuaoimh?
You can find me on Twitter at Cuaoimh. If you can spell that, well done. It's kind of an intelligent test in itself. I'm also Cuaoimh MacDonald on Facebook, or if those fail for you, whitehairedirishman.com. We've got as a website for obvious reasons. All one word, whitehairedirishman.com.
That's it. Until next week. And remember to read on.